Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Dusty White of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hummelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're asking the question, did Jesus descend to hell?
Why are we asking that? Well, did he, Mike?
But that's why we're having this conversation, because it seems that there are differing answers
There's
to this
differing
question.
Answers. Chris and I disagree right now. I'm going to win him over by the end of the podcast.
No, that's not going to happen.
All right, so this question actually arises out of, we had this question asked by multiple people in our church because we use the Apostles' Creed every time we do a baptism. We use it regularly in our worship liturgy. And of course, it's the most sort of historic and time-tested of the early creeds that Christians often recite. It's the simplest. It's the clearest. It's the one that lots of people have memorized as they went through discipleship or catechism classes as children. And in the Apostles' Creed is this phrase, you know, when we talk about Jesus Christ, who was conceived of the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell, is the way the creed reads. At Coram Deo, we usually say he descended to the dead because there is some question and difference of opinion over did Jesus descend into hell and what is the creed trying to capture here? So the reason for this podcast is this question came back on the radar as Chris and I were studying 1 Peter 3, because in 1 Peter 3 is one of the only texts in the Bible that supports this idea that Jesus descended into hell. And so as we were studying it, we sort of got, I told Chris, I went deep down the rabbit hole on this, man. I was like reading the church fathers and, I mean, doing Greek study, and I went deep. And I came out realizing, I think I agree that Jesus did in fact descend into hell, if we rightly understand what that phrase means. Chris does not agree because either he doesn't agree with what the phrase means or he just is okay with the word the dead, but not hell.
Yeah, I'm totally good with descended to the dead because I don't think that this passage teaches that that's where Jesus went.
Yes.
So it's a larger thing.
So here's the question. We want to frame this out just because it's an interesting theological topic. What happened between Friday and Easter Sunday? Where was Jesus? And does the Bible intend to teach us that after he physically died, that he descended somewhere into the underworld and preached to those who were there? Because what Peter says in 1 Peter 3:18 19, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah. And Peter's here talking about the work of Christ. And so there's certainly some complexities. And as I will say or have said, Martin Luther feels like this is one of the most confusing passages in the entire New Testament. And so we're certainly, it's less than clear what Peter is intending to say here. Let me do this. I'm just going to make the case for why I think Jesus descended into hell and what I think that phrase intends to tell us. And then I'm going to let Chris make the case for his reading of the passage. And then we're going to have a vote and see who wins. No, I'm kidding. So here's what's interesting. The word hell in English, when we hear that word, I think we think of something different than what the biblical writers often have in mind. Because there are four different words in the scriptures for the idea of the underworld. Let's just call it that. Hell, as we talked about when we did the podcast on heaven, earth, and hell, we were doing Josh Butler's book. Hell is understood theologically as a future state. It's after God judges heaven and earth, and as he brings the new heavens and the new earth, he casts out evil from his kingdom, and hell is sort of the place where evil is contained. And so when we theologically hear the word hell, we naturally associate that with final judgment and final punishment. There's also in Scripture this place called Sheol in the Old Testament and Hades in the Greek language. And this place never was meant by the biblical authors to imply a sense of final punishment or of torment or of God's absence. In fact, reading from the Erdmann's Bible Dictionary, they say this, "Except for an oblique reference to Sheol as a place of thirst, the Old Testament nowhere suggests that it is a place of torment for the wicked. Rather, it is the general abode of all the dead." Okay, so for instance, if we look at Psalm 88, verses 3 through 5, My soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to Sheol. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like a man that has no strength, like one set loose among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. So in the mindset of the Old Testament, Sheol, the whole problem with death is you don't exist anymore in the same way. Now, they understood the existence of the soul. So there's a sense of you still exist, but you don't exist in a place where you can be remembered, in a place where you have agency. You're not anymore in a place where the people of the earth can interact with you. And so they developed this concept of Sheol, which is essentially this just, it's the grave is the easiest way, is the other way that the Old Testament translates it, the grave. And you can see in Psalm 88, Sheol and the grave used in parallelism. So when the New Testament authors, when the Jewish rabbis translated the Old Testament into Greek in the Septuagint, they used the Greek term Hades to translate the Hebrew term Sheol. And here's the interesting thing about that choice. The word Hades, by the time they do that translation, has been established, for instance, in the work of Homer and in Greek literature as sort of the Greek version of the underworld. So if you've ever studied Greek mythology, they're very into like the underworld and the possibility of people traveling there and like, you know, encountering the shadows of those who have lived before. And there's all these, you know, there's the guy that takes you across the river to, you know, across the river Styx to the underworld. And so there's this whole sort of mythology of the underworld, and the New Testament writers just sort of grab this term Hades and say, yeah, that's what Sheol is. Because again, they're trying to adapt it for a Greek audience, and they're saying in a Greek person's mind, when they think of Hades, that's basically what the Old Testament writers mean by Sheol. It's this place of the dead, this place where sort of disembodied spirits are. They're not in torment. It's not a place of final judgment. It's just a place of like disembodiment, okay? So all of that to say, sometimes in the English New Testament, the word hell is used when the Greek text says Hades. And I think that confuses the average English reader because, again, they're not saying hell as in a sense of a place of torment. They're saying the place of the dead, okay? Revelation 1:18, for instance, Jesus says, "Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades." What Jesus is saying there is, I've conquered death and I've conquered this place of disembodied spirits. I'm sovereignly, my resurrection has conquered all of this. I have the keys to these places. Now I'm in charge. And that's something, he's saying something different there than later on when he will say, you know, he's going to cast the wicked into the lake of fire, reserved for the devil and his angels. All right, so that's the basic biblical background for 1 Peter 3, where Peter says, Jesus was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. And the question is, who are the spirits? What is the prison? And why are the spirits in prison? And what is Jesus doing there? And as you can imagine, that's fraught with some interpretive difficulties. My reading of this passage, to put it quite simply, is the word prison here is the Greek word phulake, which is a word that means pit, which is the same word that's in the Septuagint version of Psalm 88 when he says, "You won't let my life go down to the pit." So I am of the opinion that when it says that Jesus went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, what this is intending to teach us is Jesus, after his physical death, descends to the place, the underworld, Sheol, Hades, and proclaims his victory there in the same way that Revelation 1:18 hints at. Why does Jesus have the keys of death and Hades? Because he has triumphed over them. He's proclaimed his victory to them. And then we see later on in the passage in verse 21, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God. So we see death, descent, resurrection, ascension. And I think what Peter is intending to teach us here is that the victory of Christ in his life, death, and resurrection is far-reaching. There's no place of heaven, earth, the underworld, where Jesus has not declared his victory and where his victory does not obtain. That's my short rendering of 1 Peter 3. And for that reason, based on my study of this passage, I believe that it's okay when the creed says he descended to hell. It's not saying, and this is what English hearers think. They think it's saying, so you're saying God punished Jesus in hell? No. We're not saying Jesus went to hell. We're saying he descended to Hades, to the place of the dead, proclaimed his victorious triumph there. And by the way, I think it's fair to say, and again, this is, I'm making a theological case here more than an exegetical one. But if you have to ask the question, what about godly people in the Old Testament who died before the time of Christ, right? So what about Abraham, and what about Moses, and what about David, and what about these great saints of the Old Testament? What happened to them when they died, especially in light of texts like Psalm 88, where it says, I was like one going down to the pit. There's this sense of they don't want to be left in Sheol. I think that part of what First Peter is telling us is that Jesus in his descent is both proclaiming his victory to disobedient, disembodied spirits, and he's also proclaiming his victory and his salvation to the Old Testament saints who, in a sense, are disembodied and awaiting their final resurrection and reunification with their bodies in the new heavens and the new earth. So there you go, Chris. You're grinning at me because I gave you a lot to chop up right there. Chris is now going to dismantle my arguments in less than 5 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So let me start by saying where you landed as far as the overall points of the passage, as far as Christ's victory over the extent of his victory.
Yeah, that'll preach. You like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, completely in agreement with that.
You didn't have to descend to hell to get that.
Just what how that is being articulated, I would say, is different than what you've laid out. While there's maybe some overlap, and I think you did a really good job of laying out the differences of, you know, this concept of death and Sheol versus a place of punishment. But just to throw out, kind of fill out this picture a little bit more. First of all, related to the Apostles' Creed, I think it's important for us, even just with our historical theology, to understand that the Apostles' Creed, while it's a very popular statement,
it wasn't from the apostles, is what you're saying.
It wasn't from the apostles,
oh, okay.
And it's never been viewed by any church council as a test of orthodoxy.
Yes, true.
So in the sense, like the Nicene Creed has been a test of orthodoxy. And the Apostles' Creed has a much more, I don't know if mysterious is too strong of a term, but it sort of developed under the radar, and we have snippets of it. And, yeah. And so it wasn't...
We don't have like a final version until like 800 AD, I think.
Right, yeah. Right. So
just, when you hear the phrase Apostles' Creed, don't think Peter and Paul sat around and wrote this. That's not what happened.
Right, right. So, I mean, the Apostles' Creed is a fantastic summary of our faith, and we should value it. We should recite it. It should have a central place in our confession. But just... I say all that to say what we're debating here and what we're talking about here is not an issue of are we inside or outside orthodoxy. You know, we're not violating church
You're
council.
You're not a heretic because you don't think Jesus descended into hell.
Right. Or if you do believe that, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
No. So anyway, just as, you know, understanding some of the dynamics of that. The other piece of this is this viewpoint that what is called the descensus viewpoint, that Christ descended, rose largely as a theological question, not an exegetical one. Meaning this question, and you hit on it, Bob, what do we do with the Old Testament saints? What do we do with those who came before Christ? How is it possible for them to believe in Jesus if we believe Jesus is the way to salvation? And so early church fathers started to wrestle this out. And this passage, first of all, the sort of the theology of it began to develop, and then this passage became, oh, here's a way to support that view. But it also raised a number of questions, such as, is it possible for someone to believe in Christ after they've died? That seemed to sort of open up that question and that possibility, which...
And we should say some of the church fathers used it that way to say, yeah, Jesus went and gave a second chance to these dead people,
yes,
who hadn't
exactly
trusted him when they were alive, and therefore you sort of see the beginnings of the doctrine of purgatory,
yes,
in that.
Yes, yes. And so this
I do not hold, just to be clear.
Exactly, exactly. And so there this has been an interesting theological discussion in the place of this passage. And so you had church fathers like Clement and Origen who held to this view that Jesus descended into hell because they wanted to make, you know, they really theologically wanted to be able to affirm that, yeah, Old Testament saints had to believe in Jesus, and Jesus went to them and spoke to them and proclaimed to them. Well, Augustine comes along and says, hold the fort here. He did not like this idea of sort of a post-mortem chance to believe in Christ. And so he actually came up with a different interpretation that is something entirely different than what either Bob or I will, you know, will argue for, but which we should bring Gary in because he holds to this
Gary
view.
Gary does have this view, yeah.
Yeah, that this passage is talking about Jesus, or actually the Spirit of Christ preaching through Noah, the gospel through Noah. And so it's kind of an Old Testament, New Testament connection.
All right, get to what you think about the passage.
So here is why I have issues with some of your, well, first of all, being that the theological aspect of this, the theology developed first, and then the exegesis was sort of brought along
Whatever.
To fit that.
Well, I'll refute that in a minute.
But here are some of the exegetical issues that I have with this. First of all, and I think the big one here is this phrase, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. So that made alive in the Spirit, how you interpret that phrase, the meaning of that phrase, dictates which way you go with that text. Sure. For me, I have a hard time reading that statement as talking about Jesus in his state of being dead, because unless you're going to say Jesus went, descended into hell and in his resurrected bodily form, which I don't think you're saying.
Correct. I'm not saying that.
Then you have to
he went in the Spirit.
Right. And so you have to render that statement in a way that I think is problematic, because, and here's the thrust of it. It says Jesus was made alive. You can't be made alive unless you've been killed, right?
Correct.
So how is that not speaking of Jesus in his resurrected form?
Very much could be.
Yes. And that's, and so that, and so if you believe that that's, that opens up some different exegetical interpretations.
Gotcha.
About where did Jesus go. So I think, you know, just on that level is where I would put my first pushback.
Love it.
So
continue.
Throw that up there. I'm throwing that out there.
Oh, you
are. What say you to that one?
Well,
what
I say, Jesus recapitulates the experience of every godly saint of the Old Testament, which is, to quote Psalm 16, David, therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. So David's trusting this promise of, I know I'm going to die, but you're not going to abandon me in Sheol. And so in my opinion, what Jesus is doing, what's interesting is Acts 2, Peter's sermon at Pentecost, he quotes that text as proof of Jesus. He says, David said, you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. Therefore, God raised Jesus from the dead. And so I think what we're supposed to see is Jesus, just like every Old Testament saint, his body dies, his spirit is alive. Made alive. You don't, you think the word, you're going to make the word made carry a lot of freight, which I'll just.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We'll agree to disagree there. Cause you're putting a lot of freight on the word made, but I'm just saying, I do not think made alive in the Spirit has to mean he was dead and then was made alive. But I think the contrast is he's put to death in the flesh, but he's made alive in the Spirit. He goes in the Spirit, proclaims his victory to the spirits in prison in Sheol, is then bodily resurrected and ascends bodily to heaven. And that's where, again, we believe in the bodily resurrection. And so the question is, my question to you, Chris, tongue in cheek, is, well, then where was Jesus between Friday and Sunday? Was he alive or was he dead? Well, and if he was dead, was his spirit dead or just his body? Where was the spirit of the Lord Jesus between Friday and Sunday?
Well, with God in paradise. I mean, I think that's a good question, but I don't think this passage is dealing with where Jesus was in between his death and resurrection.
Correct. I do.
So that's, yeah. Yes. I think the temporal piece.
You
of
just think,
when did he preach?
Eschatologically, he was made alive in the Spirit, so we can just avoid whatever happened.
Well, eschatologically and bodily, he was made alive in the Spirit, and it's in that state of resurrection that he is going and doing this preaching.
We should say, the Greek language is notoriously fluid here, and to Chris's point, the phrase made alive in the Spirit could also be translated made alive by the Spirit, in the sense that the Holy Spirit is the agent who resurrected Jesus from the dead, which the scriptures do teach. So you're on good ground here.
Yeah. And so here, I guess I am putting a lot of freight in the word made alive there, but the reason I'm doing that is because there's a contrast here, death and then life here that Peter is setting up, and the parallelism in the Greek, to being put to death in the flesh, made alive in the Spirit. That's a contrast between you're dead, you were killed, and then now you've been made alive.
But
if
you believe this refers to bodily resurrection, why wouldn't I write being put to death in the flesh, but then made alive in the flesh?
Very good question.
Let me throw something at you guys. So based on everything you guys just said, Douglas Wilson, in his article called Christ's Death and Ours from his blog, he says that what Christ did in his resurrection, in his death, resurrection, and ascension is he took the Old Testament place of death and raised it up, took paradise from under the earth to the heavens in his ascension. And then he points to the verse in Matthew 27, verse 51, at the death of Jesus. Behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Verse 52, the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So it seems that Jesus did something
to death.
To death.
And to the place of the dead.
He went to that underworld place and brought that place to the heavenlies.
That's what I'm saying, Mike. So, right.
But here's another question I have with that, though. This statement, like what it appears to be the spirits in this prison don't just seem to be the general dead. There seems to be, because they formerly did not obey in the time of Noah. So there seems to be these spirits are not just dead people. They're people that have disobeyed. So there's a sense of judgment
here.
Yes,
agreed. Hmm. Agreed. I agree with that, yes.
So it's, I think that's... I don't disagree theologically with what... With that idea, like what Douglas Wilson says, I just don't know if in this text it seems to be a little more specific.
Well, and guys, at the very least, one thing that we learn from this conversation is how much theology and exegesis depend on one another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Like our theology informs how we read, and what we read needs to reshape our theology. And so it's impossible to come to a text like 1 Peter 3 apart from asking the question, okay, are there broader theological considerations here? So I just appreciate that, like, we're trying to do exegesis. What does the text say? We're also trying to do what do we know of the work of Christ, and what might that imply that Peter's saying here?
Yeah. So to go back to your question about the made alive in the spirit here, just to pull in, and again, to your point again, Bob,
you're going to make Peter be Paul right now.
I'm going to make Peter be Paul. Well, so there is a sense where we want to let Peter speak as, you know, Peter, and not that Peter and Paul are in contrast with each other, but be careful not to read Peter and his theology just through the lens of what Paul wrote. But if they're both apostles, there's going to be concepts that overlap here. And so I think 1 Corinthians 15 is very important, and where Paul talks about the resurrected form of Christ and the resurrection form that we will eventually have is something different. It's in the realm of the spirit. It's not just our normal average physical bodies that are going to be resurrected. So I'll read a little bit from 1 Corinthians 15. I'm assuming our listeners are familiar with this passage, but this is what I think Peter is getting at in his own way with this phrase, made alive in the spirit. So this is 1 Corinthians 15, starting in verse 42. So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, who, this is Christ, became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven.
So not to interrupt, but to keep it simple for our listeners, you're essentially saying Peter's contrast of flesh-spirit might mirror Paul's contrast of flesh-spirit. And a simpler way to understand what Paul's saying, especially in 1 Corinthians 15, is to use the idea of old age, new age,
yes.
Right? Or old age,
yes.
Age to come. There's this sense of there's the old age, which is the age of the flesh and the physical, and then there's this new age of that Christ has catapulted us into by his resurrection of the restoration of all things, and those ages overlap.
Yes, and that old age, Jesus, when he was first incarnated, had this frail, broken body. When he was resurrected by the Spirit, now is a glorified body that isn't frail, it's eternal, and it's the bodies that we will have. So that's the contrast that I would say is there.
So to keep it simple, Chris, you believe Jesus went and proclaimed to what spirits in what prison?
Ah, now the fun part. and admittedly, this is where the position that I take.
You get to be a Jewish
has challenges. Jewish there are challenges here.
Rabbi or Midrash writer.
So the way that I'm interpreting this passage is that Jesus in his resurrection made alive in the spirit, that resurrection, in that state of resurrection, he is proclaiming to what the spirits in prison, I believe, are evil spiritual forces, demons. The powers, the authorities that Peter mentions at the end of this passage.
Which he does mention that again in verse 22.
And if you go to 2 Peter 2, chapter 2, verse 4, he talks about these spirits, these that have been confined to hell, that Christ is declaring his victory over them.
In what prison? Where are they?
They are in the prison that God has consigned them
to.
But
Jesus doesn't have to
actually
go there. He didn't go there.
He doesn't go there.
Went doesn't really mean went. It just means sort of like preached.
The went is not... locative.
No, that's it's good. Not See, that, you a, sound like a good commentary
good,
writer.
Good Greek.
It's not a locative.
Yeah,
this participle is not a locative participle.
It's temporal. It's dative. Yeah. So it is in his state of resurrection, so made alive in the spirit in the state of resurrection in which he proclaimed. So it's his resurrection that is proclaiming to these spirits, hey, you've been defeated. Your power is null. Christ has all victory over every evil that can be thrown at him, that can be thrown at his people. He beat it. He
Take
won.
That.
So you can see
Take
Chris
that.
And I both agree that the point of the passage is Christ's victory over everything and everyone and every spirit and every being. We just disagree on where he went and what he was proclaiming.
Yeah, where he was doing
to where.
That from.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes. And so admittedly, I mean, the interesting thing about the position that I take, as you mentioned, Bob, that some of the commentators and scholars that hold this position say Peter is drawing from concepts and imagery from Jewish apocryphal literature, like the book of First Enoch and the Watchers, which then traces to an interpretation of Genesis 6.
Yeah, let's not even go down that rabbit
which
hole. That's,
I don't hold to, but
that's a whole nother,
it becomes very interesting. So,
strange.
So there are some, admittedly, I will say that my position has questions that are not, you know, challenging and problematic, but anyway.
Dusty, you've been listening to all this. What do you think?
Well, score-wise, I really appreciate the dog or the fight that Chris has. Scratch that. As I just
appreciate
sit here,
Chris's dog.
Dog.
I was like, "What? Do you have a dog, Chris?"
The dog in the
As
fight.
As I sit here, I just really appreciate Chris's defense of his own position. And so, if I was keeping score, I think we got to kick a field goal here pretty soon.
Yeah. This is what I like about Chris. Is he ain't gonna back down.
I'm trying to
just because my seminary degree came before his. You know?
Oh,
even though we went to the same seminary.
We went to the same seminary.
So,
yeah.
You know? There you go. See, you can go to the same seminary and disagree.
Interestingly enough, all my New Testament professors at said seminary disagreed with my position, but my Old Testament professor agreed with me.
There you go.
So I don't know what that means.
The only thing I've been thinking over here is in light of the Heidelberg Catechism, why does the creed add he descended to hell? And the only answer that they give is to assure me in times of personal crisis and temptation that Christ my Lord, by suffering unspeakable anguish, pain, and tear of soul, especially on the cross, but also earlier, has delivered me from the anguish and torment of hell. So I'm actually trying to consider...
Yeah, they're following John Calvin's view there, which is Calvin's view is the descent into hell in the creed is referring to Christ's suffering on the cross, is referring to the anguish he endured, which was a hellish kind of anguish.
So I think the perplexity I have is death is mentioned twice in the creed. And so there's got to be a reason for it to be mentioned two times. Because I'm a little hung up on that. There's got to be. So although I would like to disagree, I think I have problems with Christ going to hell personally. I think that's where I'm hung up. Hades.
Descending.
The pit,
not going there.
Wherever we're going.
He's not condemned to there. He just goes.
So I think I'm personally wrapped around that. And then practically I'm just thinking about language and how much language matters, but then beyond that, practically thinking and pastorally thinking towards reciting these things and getting hung up on he descended into hell versus he descended to the dead.
Yeah. And so this is why, again, in our recitation of this creed at Coram Deo, we've chosen to use the phrase he descended to the dead, which I think captures both the idea of Sheol and Hades, but also just the idea of Christ really, really being dead and then being raised to life again. So it does take away some of the confusion that modern hearers have when they hear the word hell, apart from sort of the context we just set.
Takes away the confusion, but could perhaps, with your argument, Bob, be also taking away some really important theological ramifications.
Yeah, it could be, but I think, you know, again, as that's the beauty of preaching a book like 1 Peter, is we just get a chance to say, all right, here's the scope of Christ's victory. Let's think about it and talk about it together. And so I think you see here, hopefully, as a listener, why, man, good Bible study is so crucial, right? And why, even as we recite the Apostles' Creed and sort of these phrases become impressed upon our thinking, it's good to go, all right, what does that mean, he descended to hell? And sort of to start doing a little bit of biblical work, because again, though Chris and I sort of are digging into Greek commentaries and stuff like that, if you just have a Bible dictionary and you look up Hades, you'll find everything we're talking about. You'll find references to Sheol, and you'll find the explanation that, yeah, hell, in the sense of final judgment, is different than Hades, which is just a place of the dead. And so what we're trying to model here, again, as we have in past podcasts, is just the joy of being fascinated by the Bible and of just trying to dig in there and go as deep as you can to understand what the authors are saying.
Is it Millard Erickson said there's estimated 180 different ways you could potentially interpret this passage? So even within sort of the big camps, whether kind of the general position that you take, Bob, or the general position that I take, or the one that Gary takes, there are nuances within those big camps and disagreements within those camps on particular details. And so it's a labyrinth of this passage in many ways. And so I think this also just shows where there's wonderful opportunity for flexibility too, as we essentials that we unite on the essentials, unite on the main points of this, but then have the enjoyment of going back and forth and wrestling through some of the details to sharpen each other. Because even when you came back from your vacation all jazzed up about this position and you started articulating, I mean, it was like, so I did a paper on this passage in seminary, and I thought I was like locked up. Yeah, this is, and so you're throwing things at me. I'm like, wow, that's interesting, because you kind of nuanced some certain things, and it kind of caused me to rethink through some of that. So it's just fun, that sharpening and bouncing back and forth with these things.
Yeah, some of the joy of theological discourse and why we care about learning together. In closing, if I could just acknowledge or ask the question, what if we take the phrase "he descended into hell" out of the Apostles' Creed and just go, "he was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead." And some people prefer to do that. Some people say, yeah, there's enough confusion about this descent into hell, we're just going to take it out. I think that's sort of what John Piper advocates, is just, let's just not say that. And Grudem, the same. The challenge with that, I think, is that what most people implicitly assume is that hell is a place where the victory of Christ does not obtain. Like, when you think about, if I think about conversations I have with people about hell, their assumption is that hell is a place where God is absent. And in fact, as we talked about in our podcast on hell, God is very much the God of hell. He's simply casting evil into a place where it can't ever escape, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think this phrase is intended and was inserted into the Apostles' Creed in history with the intent of helping us understand that when Jesus is crucified, died, and is buried, it's not as though the realm of the underworld, the realm of sort of dark spiritual forces, the realm of the dead, it's not as though his victory does not touch that realm. So whatever you believe about the descent, Chris, I think we're unified in agreeing and saying, actually, part of the biblical material that we need to highlight is to say there's no spiritual force or no part of creation anywhere where Christ's victory has not been proclaimed and demonstrated. And that gives us a different sense of the importance of all that Christ has done in his work on the cross. And it's reminiscent to me of Psalm 139, where the psalmist says, "Where can I flee from your presence?" If you remember this famous psalm, he says, "If I ascend to heaven, you are there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, you are there." It's this sense of like, there's not a place on earth where God is not present. And in the same way, there's not a place anywhere in the universe where Jesus is not victorious.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's conversation, and we ask that you join us.
We ask that you vote on who won.
Yeah, shoot us your emails, podcast@cdomaha.com, or just tweet at the guys on Twitter and tell them if you agree or disagree. That Twitter arguments are really fun.
Yeah.
Just let me add that my position is the most held position today.
It is. Chris is in line with the majority of New Testament scholars today.
Yes.
Because the crowds are always usually right.
Yes, they are. They are. I am a bandwagon jumper.
Are you a Patriots fan right now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Talk about descent into hell.
That's going to do it for this week. We'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.